Hello and welcome back. We're here, as usual, in cosy Hoxton Square with another podcast for readers who like to explore lesser-known books and literary ideas. Now, last month we talked about antiquarian bookselling. Today we have a rural theme, the countryside, in both fiction and non-fiction. Now, this is a subject dear to the heart of Gail Perkis, joint founding editor here at Slightly Foxed, and the only one of us who actually lives in the countryside. But, of course, you don't need to live in rural England to feel strongly attached to it, or indeed to hold strong opinions about it. Now, Gail, I know, at the risk of overstating this, I know you do feel there are universal truths in books written about the English countryside.
Well, I have to admit, this is not an original idea of mine. Patrick Kavanagh, the Irish poet, believed very strongly that in the parochial life's universal. It's a theme that Robert McFarlane has taken up in various articles and in some of his books. And I think it reflects a very long connection in this country between the natural world and specific locations in a country which is incredibly varied. Within a very short space of time, you can move from one landscape to something completely different. We have a long tradition of books about particular areas which are focused on the local, but from which I think you can draw universal conclusions.
We're going to dig into as many as we can during the course of the podcast. Foxed co-editor Hazel Wood is also here. My name is Philippa Lamb, and we have two guests with us today. Usual rules apply, by the way, on background office noise and dogs. Tarka the Whippet is currently under the table, but entirely silent, but just be prepared in case we hear from him. And before I introduce our guest, let's have a quick update from Jenny Harrison-Bunning on the goings-on here at Fox this month.
Well, this really is the kind of final countdown to Christmas. The winter issue is actually published today, the 15th. It comes out a little bit earlier in the cycle than the other issues. It'll start going out all around the world over the next few weeks. So we get lots of gift subscriptions going off to the States and Canada, Australia.
The podcast is having a bit of success in Australia at the moment. I've noticed the numbers going up and up and up in Australia.
Yeah, Australia's doing really well. And actually, all over the place, we're getting lots of nice emails from people. The last one on antiquarian bookselling, that's gone down really well. And lots of people just saying that they didn't realise that a bookshop like that would actually be so approachable and that you could just pop in off the street
and browse
the shelves. And I went in there just before the podcast came out just to take some pictures. And I ended up with five or six books. And people are saying, but you know, I couldn't afford it if I went in there. And I did find lots of things that were under £50 and picked up a christening present for my nephew and, you know, other bits and bobs for Christmas presents. So do be encouraged.
Definitely, and particularly Henry Sutherland, that bookshop, because it's a particularly lovely one.
Exactly, and so that episode's gone down really well, and it's taken our total listens from when we started to, I think it's 110,000.
I know.
Which is, it's really gratifying just to think that many people around the world have heard little tales from our Hoxton office.
Hoxton Square.
So we're really pleased. And, you know, if you are enjoying the pod and you can face sort of going onto Apple or whatever you listen to it through and just leaving a little review, it really helps other book lovers to find the pod.
Yes, it's not just vanity on our part, this, is it? It actually does help get it up the rankings so people see it.
Yeah, it does. It's a very mysterious world that we're still coming, you know, getting to grips with.
Back to the day job for you?
Unfortunately, it's gift wrapping for me. I'll be twirling ribbons and wrestling with paper.
Enjoy. So, thanks, Jenny.
Thank you.
So, on to this month's guests, who are author, illustrator and architect Juliet Blaxland and Jay Armstrong from the Nature Journal Elementum. The reading from the Slightly Foxed archive has a rural theme this time too. Helena Drysdale on the books of the children's author B.B., who won the Carnegie Medal for British Children's Books back in 1942. Book recommendations from everyone later on, of course. But first, Juliet and Jay, come and join us. Now, we're talking about the countryside today. Juliet, you're a countrywoman. You live in rural Suffolk.
Yes.
In a fascinating house on the edge of a cliff.
Yes. I grew up in Suffolk, it's worth saying, and it's partly that local knowledge that led us to be living on the edge of the cliff, because without having known the various people and I was doing a particular job that required me to be on the cliff, and I did a little bit of borderline trespassing, which eventually led to us living in this house on the edge of a crumbling, eroding cliff at what used to be the easternmost point in the whole of the UK, but is no longer because of the coastal erosion.
And you've just written a fantastic book called The Easternmost House.
The title is also a slight nod to an old book called The Outermost House, more of which later.
Now, your book, I think, was shortlisted for the Wainwright Prize, wasn't it, this year? And you've used the house kind of poised on the edge as a peg to talk about what's going on in your rural locale over the course of a year.
Yes, I took that format partly because we have a lot of visitors in Suffolk in the summer, and I thought it was quite interesting to slightly perhaps open some people's eyes to just anchor it a little bit, to make it a real rural book. So there are plenty of earlier rural books written in the 20th century about ploughing and all of that, but I wanted to do one that was very much the 21st century, so it's still got ploughing and harvesting and animals and all of that.
Yeah.
But it's also got 21st century tensions, you might say.
Hazel, you used to live on a cliff as well, didn't you?
I did, yes. My cliff was in Devon, and it was right on the edge. But, of course, in Devon, there isn't the same problem of erosion, although not very far away from was a village called Hall Sands, which was completely submerged by the sea overnight. I think because they'd been dredging to extend the docks in Plymouth, and about 20 years later, it just completely disappeared.
And that was the early 1900s, wasn't it, I think, when that disappeared?
Yes, yes, it was. But I did recognise the feeling in your book of sort of living on the edge of the cliff.
Well, the change
and of this community as well.
The change when it comes can be quite dramatic. It happens with structural failure. You have a long period of stability and then a sort of creaking and then a crash. And that can happen with a storm surge or a particular type of tide. You can literally lose a whole dune or a view changes or something. And I think people are slightly unused to that sudden change being entirely natural, actually.
Do you have a sense of how long your house is going to be there?
I should add that we rent it right. And the loss is to the farm. But it is a known thing. I mean, this is historic erosion that's been going on over the centuries.
And you're very close, aren't you, to
the edge? Getting considerably visibly closer. We've been there for 12 years and we may have maybe two or three left.
Jay, tell us about Elementum. This lovely journal, you found it's 3 years ago, isn't it? It's non-fiction.
That's right.
And it's writing about landscapes and wildlife internationally.
Yes, we've subtitled it a Journal of Nature and Stories. So it's really quite a wide catch-all title, but we do very much look at other things than just non-fiction, so it'd be poetry, folklore, fictional retellings, as well as the use of the illustrations and the artwork to create their own narrative within it as well.
And you explore a lot of the same issues that Juliet highlights in her book.
Yes, I mean, interesting enough, as you were speaking about sort of the erosion, one of the features in edition 4 was the flooding of the Elan Valley in Wales, which was obviously for the provision of drinking water for Birmingham as it sort of expanded in the Industrial Revolution. They had to come up with a solution, and they did, but at the expense of the people who lived within the valley.
So it's like rather than water.
Very similar, yes. So the flooded buildings emerge mysteriously in the summer when there's a bit of a drought and the reservoir levels dip. So, you know, it's the impact, it's not just the natural world and its unadulterated state, but obviously it's the interface with humanity, which we are obviously part of that natural world, but we seem to have quite a larger influence on it than it on us quite often.
We've forgotten, haven't we? We've always regarded nature as being there to take what we want.
Yes.
And the oceans, we can put whatever we want into them. But actually, we've forgotten that we're interconnected.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think what we would say is happening is this disconnection, which has happened for many reasons. You could say it's because of the post-Enlightenment emphasis on the rationale. It could be to do with the increase in the urban dwelling and many other factors you can look at. But I'd say if we're going to try and do anything with Elementum, it's about restoration of some sense of connection, whether it be with something bigger than yourself, is how we put it. So time and tide are bigger and outside of our ability to control.
And that's what's so fascinating about all the books that Hazel and I love about the English countryside. Is that I think probably there's nowhere else on earth that's been documented in such detail by such talented writers over a long time. I think the current attitudes to the environment started at the beginning of the last century when we began to realise what we were losing and people began to record it.
And with the founding of the RSPB and the National Trust, I think women started both.
That's correct,
they?
Yes.
I think, you know, people were beginning to realise that.
So public awareness of people who didn't live in the countryside started to think about
That's
it more.
That's right. Yes.
The RSPB was to do with wearing feathers in your hat, and some enlightened women thought quite reasonably that it was an entirely unnecessary way to use birds.
Is that where it came from? Yeah, I didn't know that.
They literally were using the birds primarily for the hats.
And one of the first women nature photographers who was working in the 1920s actually recorded a picture of the bittern, and it proved that was back in England, this one photograph that she took. It's just quite an extraordinary blue stocking woman who carried her gamekeeper carried her kit around with her, and she was using camouflage well before other photographers and was documenting the bird life in Norfolk at that time.
And this woman's name was?
Emma Turner.
So all these ideas were coming into the public arena and novels were spawned from it. Now, Hazel, what sort of work was produced around that time? Beginning of the 20th century, isn't it, we're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, well, there were a lot of particularly children's books. Wind in the Willows, Arthur Ransom was writing about Broads.
Tark of the Otter, W.H. Hudson, yes, Hampshire yes. Days.
And sort of a bit later on, in East Anglia particularly, there was a lot of oral history, wasn't there?
There were people like Mary Webb writing about nature in, I mean, fictionalised accounts about the natural world, which actually became almost parodies.
So we saw a lot of these novels about rural life. They're quite doomy and dreadful, weren't they? Read in Tooth and Claw, and it was, you know, unwanted pregnancies and all sorts of dismal rural goings on. And then Stella Gibbons came along, didn't she, with Cold Comfort Farm.
Exactly, yes.
And parodied the entire genre in a fabulous book. If people haven't read that, I would thoroughly recommend it. It's one of my all-time favourites. It's a fabulous parody of that sort of idea of decaying farms in dank fields.
And lowering peasants and things happening in the woodshed, of course.
Exactly. Yes. So there was all that. Yes. And then there was a kind of sea change in attitudes to rural writing.
Well, I think, you know, immediately after the First World War, I mean, the number of books that came out about rural life, which was in the process of disappearing, agricultural life, which was changing out of all recognition.
The move to mechanisation.
So I think every county practically has its chronicler.
Yes, I was recently looking at George Ewart Evans, who wrote many, many books of oral history. He felt a sort of urgency. He wrote Ask the Fellows Who Cut the Hay, The Horse in the Furrow.
I think it's when they were making a transformation from horse to mechanisation, there was an enormous sense of loss when, in fact, it was change, you might say. And I think this is what's happening with erosion and rising sea levels. Some of it is genuine loss of, say, wildlife. And some of it is change that we, being maybe a bit disconnected from nature, have slightly lost the ability to adapt to these big storms and crashing trees and buildings falling down and that kind of thing.
And does that bring us to the difference in attitude towards countryside matters between rural dwellers and urban people? Because, as you say, urban people tend to be, we romanticise the change in the countryside, don't we? Whereas living in a rural and working in a rural environment, presumably that sort of change was no bad thing for a lot of people.
I think it was pretty hard, you know, life. And in many ways, it was an improvement for some people in their daily grind. One of the things I've noticed after the Easternmost House book was published, various people came out of the woodwork who had been born up on that cliff or lived on the farm. What was quite interesting, going back to the birds, was that one of them said that storks used to nest on the chimneys of the house we live in. And that really comes under the heading shifting baseline syndrome, because I literally have never seen a stork nesting in East Anglia, and they haven't been seen to breed since 1410 or something. But this man came up and said literally in the 40s and 50s they were nesting on the farm. That's the sort of knowledge that could be completely lost.
But on the other hand, we've got this wonderful, the Reader's Digest Book of Birds. I think it was published in 68. And it says the red kite, for example, pretty much you can't find it in the UK, but now you can. So,
it's
you know,
back,
it does move. It's very common now. So, you know, it's interesting, the sense of permanence, impermanence. What I love so much in the writing, which I read, and in the poetry we read, is this acceptance of impermanence, of mortality, of change, of things never quite staying the same.
Transience.
And obviously, one has to weigh it up against the ills of toxicity or bad practice or whatever that's caused that. But ultimately, you know, nature's an ever-evolving system of which we are a part.
It's funny how things go around in circles, isn't it? I recently reread Lark Rise to Candleford. There's a wonderful account in there of what they ate as a family. And of course, they had the vegetable patch. But actually, the children were sent out to forage for dandelion and sorrel. They were salad leaves. And of course, now you can pay quite a lot of money to go on a foraging course to learn which plants you can and cannot eat. But that knowledge, you know, was lost for so long.
talk about bringing natural history into the curriculum, which I think everyone is in agreement would be a tremendous thing. Because I think the other thing that's happened is science and art have separated to everyone's detriment. And, you know, if you look at the notebooks of the first scientists, they're artistic and their own merit as art form is quite exceptional. And if we separate sort of this idea of the scientist and the artist, whereas actually bringing them together, and I think Juliet talks about that in her book as well.
Well, I do remember there was a sort of craze in the 80s, I think, was it, with a country diary of the Edwardian lady or whatever it was.
Yes.
And it was
yes.
everywhere. It became a bit sort of overdone and sort of merchandised, but actually they were remarkable drawings. And it was quite normal for people to observe nature closely and to have general knowledge without being completely pedantic about identifying in a sort of taxonomy kind yeah. of way. So you would know what to eat, what not to eat, what common birds were. I think that's been lost surprisingly recently, actually. And there are people now like Mary Colwell, Curlew Moon, that book, yeah. who's a big champion of this natural history in schools. And I think that's a really excellent idea, but I would add, a bit controversially, not just about identification and recognising, but understanding prey and predator and slightly broader issues to do with why some of these birds are rare.
One of the breakthrough books, in a way, was Richard Mabey, wasn't it, and Food for Free.
When was that published?
I think in the 70s, yes.
It's still in print, or it's been reissued.
Yes.
It was a remarkable, well, a manual, part of the sort of self-sufficiency movement
yes,
as well.
Yes.
Thinking about this allowing things to flourish that maybe on the edge of extinction, I noticed in your book, Juliet, mention of Dame Miriam Rothschild, and I'd forgotten about her, and she is a most fascinating character, isn't she?
She's a good egg.
So this is, what, the 50s when she...
Actually, this is really... I mean, Prince Charles has been on this farming with nature, rewilding... Well, he wouldn't call it that, but...
But she produced
really
Farmer's Nightmare, didn't she?
She was advising him about how to increase insect life, therefore bird life, and so on. And her idea was to gather strong native plants, seeds that we would call probably weeds. And I'm quite a follower of this. I go around with my bucket just collecting stuff and then spreading it around. And she calls it Farmer's Nightmare.
I love that phrase. I had to go and look it up already.
It includes obvious things, sort of poppies or... But when you get a good mix of it, it is incredible how much it changes the balance of insect life, flower life. And so there is an amazing photo that I love. It says Dame Miriam Rothschild stopped gardening conventionally in the 1950s. And there's some sort of hint of a quite nice house behind her, but you can't really see it because there's all this sort of jungle.
And she was known as Queen of the Fleas,
I saw when
I went looking at her.
Yes, Rothschild collection.
She was
fleas.
A world expert, wasn't she? I was intrigued because I didn't know about her, and now here we are at this much-discussed idea of rewilding. Mm.
To some extent, I think it's quite a fair amount of re-scruffing where you leave a bit more. I mean, in East Anglia, which is always associated with being a sort of chemical-drenched wasteland, but actually there are huge amounts of marginal, like...
So that strange noise is Tarka, just ignore it.
...woodland, and there's a lot of shooting in East Anglia. Equally, there's an enormous amount of established woodland that was originally either planted or allowed for cover for shooting. So what's happening now is there are areas where much greater proportions of estates, 10% or more, where either species like large grazing animals are going to be reintroduced, so pigs runkling around, then the acorns take... And then that encourages new woodland. But the key to it all is that you do need to grow food. But if you can connect up these estates and have wildlife corridors and connected rewilding parts of the estates, the key is to make it a sort of grid over much landscape scale areas. And then they can migrate ideally from, say, Sussex to East Anglia and up to the Midlands. And
it's also, I think, worth making the point that a lot of the land is what would have been called marginal land. It's only during and after the Second World War when, you know, we were encouraged to plough up water meadows and pastures that had never been ploughed that we expanded food production.
Isabella Tree, that's one of the most interesting things.
This is Isabella Tree's book, isn't it, Wilding? Yeah.
That having had these various pigs and longhorns, Tamworths, Let's say you look forward a bit, maybe 50 years, 75 years. They have then restored the living soil. So you're back to Lady Eve Balfour, the Soil Association. Living soil restoration is a part of it. So it may be able to be ploughed up in the future for another 50 years of feeding us.
Interesting. Have you covered this, Jay, in Elementor?
I commissioned a piece by Jim Crumley, who's a Scottish writer who has been doing this sort of writing for 50-odd years. And he wrote a piece for us called The Wolf Tree. He took the Fortingale yew, the ancient yew tree, as a starting point, and he really went back to when that tree was a sapling and what Scotland looked like at that point, which was a fascinating piece. And, you know, I can't comment from an agricultural or scientific point of view, but I do think that what the wolf does and the lynx and all these animals, they feed into a different imagination, and we can imagine our landscape in a different form with different inhabitants and what that looked like. And I think that is an important part of our history, perhaps, that we weren't aware of at school, for example. That
a lot of misconceptions, I think, at school. Because I certainly grew up with the idea that, you know, England was covered in ancient woodland. And in fact, England was covered in ancient scrubland, wasn't it, is the reality.
Round us, which is, you know, fairly heavily wooded now, when you walk through the woods, there are the remains of walls everywhere. These are fields that, within living memory, were actually tilled. There's a 93-year-old who lives in the village, and she can remember ploughing with her father. And on the moor where they, because there are less animals grazing now, the scrub, the pioneer species like birch and rowan are all beginning to creep up the hillside.
It's a question of balance, isn't it? You've got so many people who've lived and farmed in a certain way for hundreds of years. And if you go, for instance, to Swaledale, those amazing barns in the corner of stone-walled fields, that seems worth keeping. But there are marginal areas where maybe it's about balance and having a sort of mosaic of different joined-up habitats.
So in the same way that, you know, we were talking earlier about the beginning of the 20th century, literature started to reflect the changing ideas about the countryside, what it was, what it was for, its role in society, are we starting to see yet fiction coming through that's absorbing the things we've been talking about that are happening now, or is it still in the non-fiction arena?
I think there's a lot of fiction where landscape either is almost a character within that book. And one particular book which I thoroughly enjoyed was Adlands by Tom Bullock, which is really the whole life of a farmer in the Welsh hills. And it's a fascinating read. And it's not dissimilar to the whole life that was shortlisted for the International Booker Prize. So it's taking one life and it's dwelling within that landscape for a whole lifetime. And I think that's one thing which fiction allows, is to interrogate a particular place in a way that non-fiction has elements of that, but certainly the fictional element, you can really tell a story through that character and through the landscape as well.
That's back to Gail's original point, isn't it? About truths written in fiction about these subjects. You've got one too, haven't you, Julia?
All Among the Barley, set in Suffolk by Melissa Harrison. It isn't set in the present day, it's set in the 30s, with thoughts about excessive nostalgia being perhaps symptomatic of, in that particular book, the rise of fascism, but quite subtly woven in, so that taking an excess interest in, oh, you country people with your quaint ways kind of thing. And that is slightly relevant because we do have to modernise and adapt. And in the easternmost house, I've put things like combine harvesters driven by men, because that is currently the situation. But I think quite soon, some of my life experiences will seem quite quaint. We may have unmanned tractors,
automated machinery,
whatever.
Yeah, like
to
the States.
To be too nostalgic, for instance, my childhood in the 70s, that is actually a time of huge destruction and intensive agriculture, which I think the way East Anglia is farmed today is vastly better than it was when I was a child. So that's just a little warning about nostalgia.
Do you think it'd be fair to say we're at a point now where there's a lot of ideas, we talked about a lot of them in this conversation, a lot of ideas about the countryside and rural life right now, but we haven't actually arrived at the next direction of travel quite, it seems to me. Well, what's next in your journal, in your next edition?
So, I mean, interesting enough, the next edition is balance. And I think that answers your question. I think it is a question of balance. You know, we take our wonderful technology and our extraordinary brains, but we need to use it mindfully and cautiously, and also with a sense of looking beyond our own generation. And And I think, you know, post Second World War, it was a survival. We all had to feed ourselves in those difficult times. But I think we can now afford ourselves a sense of being able to use what we have and look a bit more wisely. But obviously, balance-wise, I think there is also a polarization is occurring in ecological thought, which I don't necessarily think is healthy. There needs still to be a place for debate. And what we try and do editorially is create a space where it's about what we all have in common rather than what we disagree on.
Evidence-based conversations as well.
Evidence-based conversations, but not perhaps discounting the gut feeling. Mm. And I think, again, the disconnect of the head from the heart post-Enlightenment has been one of our biggest problems. There are experts who write, and then there are those who write from observation. And they are bringing new ways of looking at the landscape. Maybe not new ideas, but new ways of looking. And nothing really works, I don't think, without story. So there's plenty of good storytellers out there.
In many of these conversations, it's builders either or. We either do rewilding or we grow food. We either go vegan or we brutally cruel to animals all the time. When actually the dull truth is we probably want to do both and many of these things can coexist in a sort of patchwork, a mosaic, connecting.
As Jay says, balance. I'm going to wrap this up, otherwise we'll be here all day, but really interesting conversation. Thank you. Let's move on now to our reading from the Slightly Foxed archive. Hazel, what are we going to hear?
Well, this is a piece written by Helena Drysdale about two wonderful children's books that we reissued, Little Grey Men and Down the Bright Stream, written by someone who called himself BB.
In 1970, I told BB how much I loved his books. I wrote the letter sitting in a house tucked into a Devon cliff with pine woods behind and the sea in front. It was the sort of place BB would have adored. The recesses of undergrowth and exposed headlands teeming with wildlife. This, I imagined, was the setting for his book, The Little Grey Men. Here were all the ingredients, including foxes, badgers, and above all, a winding stream. In my mind, this was the Folly Brook, up which the last gnomes in England travel on their heroic quest to find their missing brother, and down which they flee in their boat in the sequel Down the Bright Stream. BB thanked me for my letter. He told me he lived in a round house built in the year that Samuel Pepys began his diary. It had a weather vane in the form of a wild goose, which he himself had designed, so that its beak always faced into the wind. "I hope you will one day read my books to your children," he wrote, "though by then I shall have flown away like my wild goose." BB wrote 60 books and illustrated them all, but the Carnegie Medal-winning The Little Grey Men, published in 1942, remains his most popular. The first edition had exquisite scraperboard illustrations by Dennis Watkins Pitchford, which capture the scary enormity of the landscape inhabited by these tiny men. One-legged dodder kippers minnows for supper, a few deft lines evoking the circle of firelight that illuminates his bulbous nose and shaggy beard. Bald Money and Sneezewort disappear furtively behind gigantic grass stems. Dodder catches a ride from a heron, his head reaching as high as the heron's knees. There can be few other combinations of text and illustration that work so harmoniously. And this is because BB and Dennis Watkins Pitchford were one and the same. He adopted the pseudonym BB because it was less of a mouthful. As he says in his introduction to The Little Grey Men, some books portray miniature people with ridiculous tinsel wings doing impossible things with flowers and cobwebs. Then he adds, "That sort of make-believe is all right for some people, but it won't do for you and me." His gnomes are never sentimental or twee. They're just a short, imaginative step from the woodland creatures that are their friends. Yet his gnomes also lead a cozy domestic life. As a child, I yearned to live as they did, in a hollow oak, swigging elderberry wine from snail shells. That combination of wild and domestic is like Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows. The little grey men mess about in boats, have adventures, and enjoy each other's companionship. Dodder shares Ratty's gruff self-reliance, while Restless Cloudberry has a touch of Mr. Toad. It is Cloudberry's adventurous spirit that inspires the journey in the first book, and his toadish rashness that triggers all sorts of dramas in the second. As writers, Beebe and Kenneth Graham were divided by the World Wars, and the gnomes' lives reflect that in being more perilous than those of the Edwardian Ratty et al. They confront shipwreck, starvation, and murderous pikes, stoats, and foxes. Their greatest enemy, however, is man. And it is mankind that threatens their existence. This is the 1940s, and bombers loom in the background of Down the Bright Stream. But more devastating for the gnomes is environmental destruction. Beebe's nostalgia for an unwrecked England carries a double blow today. We share his sense of doom as the Folly Brook is diverted into a pipe and the gnome's hollow oak is felled, and we add our own awareness of how much things have since deteriorated. Beebe describes elm trees, unaware that they would be wiped out by disease. He describes flower-filled water meadows, unaware that most would be drained or covered in housing. Major characters in the books are water voles, but now it seems that almost all of England's water voles have vanished. The books also generate nostalgia for our own childhoods, when our senses were more alert to the natural world, largely because we were closer to the ground. A sickly child, Beebe was kept at home and given no formal education. Instead, he explored his surroundings and lost himself in fishing, collecting eggs and caterpillars, and learning the calls and habits of birds. That absorption in the countryside is what makes these books so captivating. Beebe's attention to detail, to subtle changes in weather, the migration of swifts or the scent of willow buds, reminds us to notice such things again. I never met Beebe. Following our correspondence, my mother and I made a pilgrimage to see him in Northamptonshire, but sadly he was away, for which he was deeply apologetic. "Dates change continuously with the wayward way of a weathercock," he wrote. He died in 1990, flying away like his wild goose weather vane, just before my first child was born.
That was Helena Drysdale's piece, Beside the Folly Brook. It was from issue 55, and our thanks to Helen Bourne for reading it so beautifully. Juliet, you were saying you read them when you were a child.
I remember The Little Grey Men, and it seemed an extremely old book at the time, and certainly BB was sort of, he seemed ancient. But I do think if you start from a child knowing literally nothing, they're of great introduction to what is a badger. And then once you know about badgers and foxes and hares and water voles, then you start to care about them.
OK, moving on, book recommendations from everyone shortly. First, a word about the Slightly Foxed Quarterly magazine. Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for non-conformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors. And since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. OK, recommended reads from everyone, please. But before we get that, I just have to say Tark is advancing on the table where we're recording, so we may hear from him shortly. Jay, do you want to start us off?
Yes, so in the spirit of the Booker Prize, I thought I might bring two books to the table.
Sure.
And the first one is a wonderful fiction by Laura Beatty called Pollard, which is out of print. It was published in 2008 by Chatto & Windus. And it'd be delightful if a certain publisher could maybe bring Anne back to life again, who is the protagonist.
Not looking at Gail and Hazel at this point at
all.
Yeah.
It was one of those books where you finish it and it echoes with you for weeks and weeks. And I was completely astounded by it. It's about Anne, a bag lady, and she is really sort of rejected by society and goes to live in a wood. And she survives and she finds her own way. But she is very much a Jedermann and everyman. She is almost each of us. And it's utterly fascinating. She's a bit like the Hobbit in The Lord of the Rings. It's the unaffected humanity, her innocence. She falls in love. She longs for a child. She makes a home for herself. So she does what humans do. And the woodland itself is a character within the book. And Laura just writes so beautifully. And I think this book was really quite ahead of its time. I would highly recommend it. And the copy I have is a library copy because they're quite hard to get hold of.
Sounds great.
And I wanted to bring some poetry because I think that's perhaps an underrepresented genre.
Yeah.
Jane Clarke's second poetry collection called When the Tree Falls. She's an Irish poet, very much influenced by Heaney's work. She writes in the vernacular, very much sort of rooted in the countryside. She was brought up on a farm in Roscommon. And this collection of poetry weaves around the death of her father. And there's this beautiful line about he was buried under the soil that he loved. It's just so simple, but hugely poignant and very strong writing.
Hazel.
Well, I'd like to recommend a book called Plot 29 by Alan Jenkins, who is, I think, the editor of the Observer Food magazine. He grew up round about the same time as I did in the West Country in Plymouth, when it was a sort of grim post-war place. And he was in a children's home. And then he and his brother were fostered by a couple who lived on Dartmoor. They were an elderly couple, and at first it was absolutely idyllic. And that's when he learned to grow things. But the fostering went wrong. And the form of the book is it moves between this very difficult growing up and his present life, his allotment in London, and he's married to a Danish wife, so he has a house in Denmark as well. It sort of moves between his trying to come to terms with his past through his garden, and I found it very touching. In the end, it's a very sad story, of course, but the hopeful thing about it is that, you know, he has made a present, and he's done it really through the earth, you might say.
Julie.
Henry Beston, The Outermost House, was the spark for The Easternmost House.
You mentioned that earlier, yes.
And it's been reissued recently.
Can I just jump in there? Because we've got a lovely article about it coming in the spring issue next year.
Well, isn't that timely?
It was published, I think, in 1928, and he was bemoaning then that we were all becoming disconnected from nature, and he lived a year of life on the Great Beach at Cape Cod. The second book, or really it's a whole collection, is to revisit Gavin Maxwell, who might be a bit sort of unfashionable in certain ways, but Ring of Bright Water is the most famous, but I personally don't think it's the best of his books, and I think it's well worth revisiting The House of Elrig,
which we've reissued as a slightly foxed edition.
Ring of Bright Water is part of a trilogy, so they're all well worth revisiting. Yeah. Oh, and one more thing, actually.
Uh-huh.
The Fox's Prophecy is a poem written in, I think, 1870 by D.W. Nash. And it's really prescient. It's actually a fox telling you what's going to happen. You can buy it as a book, but actually I've noticed that you can also just Google it and read it. And it's actually amazing how incredible insights into what's going to happen that we're living through now.
Gail.
I'm halfway through a wonderful memoir of a man called Reynold Stone, written by his son Humphrey Stone. And Reynold Stone was a very distinguished wood engraver and letter carver who also produced some rather wonderful watercolours. He lived in Dorset and was completely wedded to the place. The range of his work is astonishing. He did a lot of colophons for publishers. He carved the memorial to Winston Churchill in Westminster Abbey. He did the masthead for the Times, the London Library's book plate. I mean, the list is endless, yeah. Isn't it? But the wood engravings above all, which are countryside scenes, are just wonderful. And it's a very heartwarming book because it's obviously, Humphrey's obviously devoted to his father and his work. It's a joy.
You'll find details of all those books, indeed all the books we've mentioned actually, in the show notes attached to this episode on your podcast app, or indeed on the website, along with all the Slightly Fox books, and if you're tempted, the application to subscribe to the quarterly magazine, foxedquarterly.com. That's it for this month, but our thanks to Juliet and to Jay.
Thank you very much.
We will be back on 15th of December with a podcast about sparking a love of reading. Thanks so much for listening and for joining us in our regular trek off the beaten literary track.